Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue. Very brief update on Joe, since I know a lot of people are curious. He did have his procedure on Tuesday. He did go home yesterday, and he is planning to be back tomorrow. If I hear otherwise, and I'm on with you tomorrow, you'll know, and I'll tell you that then. But he should be back tomorrow, everybody. Joining me today for the roundtable panel, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning, Malia.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing well. I am sitting in my home office, and I have a beautiful view of a cherry tree in full bloom.
Oh.
I just love this time of spring.
Wonderful. No, it's a really good tree blossom spring, too. Everywhere in the region that I've been is just gloriously soft and colorful looking, which is a lovely thing compared to, you know, the rest of life. Also in studio today, we have publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Sarah. Very nice to see you. Glad to be here.
Nice to see you as well.
Good morning to everyone else.
And preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Hope everybody's doing all right.
Thank you. Hope the same back to you. Now, we have a short panel this morning. The Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments in the case of Trump versus the United States, which is a case involving potential presidential immunity from crimes. That special coverage will begin at about 9:50, and we will end the panel then to bring you the special coverage from NPR, live anchored special coverage. We are not going to preview that case much today because we will have the special coverage. The NPR anchors will explain it. And then, of course, tomorrow there will be news about it. So I imagine it'll be the first and primary topic on tomorrow's show. Instead, we will talk about something that happened yesterday after the program, which is this. But before I tell you this, I want to remind you that you can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. Yesterday's news, well, in today's news, ongoing news, but something that broke yesterday. An Arizona grand jury has indicted former President Donald Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, lawyer Rudy Giuliani, and 16 others for their roles in an attempt to overturn Trump's loss to Joe Biden in the 2020 election. The indictment released yesterday, names 11 Republicans who submitted a document to Congress falsely declaring that Trump won Arizona in 2020. They include the former party state chair, a 2022 U.S. Senate candidate, and two sitting state lawmakers who are charged with 9 counts each of conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. This text from the AP. The identities of 7 other defendants, including Giuliani and Meadows, were not immediately released because they had not yet been served with the documents. They were readily identifiable based on descriptions of the defendants, however. Trump himself is not charged, but has been referred to as an unindicted co-conspirator. Officially referred to in the documents. With the indictments, Arizona becomes the 4th state where allies of the former president have been charged with using false or unproven claims about voter fraud related to the election. Heading into a likely November rematch with Biden, Trump continues to spread lies about the last election that are echoed by many of his supporters. I will not allow American democracy to be undermined, says Democratic State Attorney General Chris Mays. He said in a video released by his office yesterday, it's too important. The indictment alludes to Giuliani as an attorney who is often identified as the mayor and spread false allegations of election fraud. Another defendant is referred to as Trump's chief of staff in 2020, which describes Meadows. Descriptions of the other unnamed defendants points to Mike Roman, who is Trump's director of Election Day operations, John Eastman, a lawyer who devised a strategy to try to persuade Congress not to certify the election, and Christina Bob, a lawyer who worked with Giuliani. There are many other people and probably other parts of this to relay, but let us begin conversing, and I will start with you, Ira. What do you think?
Well, I'm toggling between what took them so long to do these indictments and better late than never.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've sort of gotten, I don't want to say we're off track. We've been talking about all of the other problems that Trump et al. Have gotten involved with. But at the heart of all of this, or the heart of most of this, is the scheme to falsify election results. And, the law is a complex thing and the wheels of justice move slowly. But based on what we know and based on what we think the prosecutors know, this looks like a slam dunk, and it's just too bad we've had to wait this long, and I don't know whether or not it'll be adjudicated before the election, which is a problem.
Terry?
Well, it is good to see the wheels of justice continuing to move forward. And I think this does send a signal to others that may in the future want to try to do similar efforts to overturn elections to be cautious of what they do, and that the judicial system does have ways of tracking you down and holding you accountable. I am concerned in terms of the public opinion aspect of this, is how much the public is really paying attention to this anymore. It seems like we've just been living with this topic in the news for so long now that it's just kind of become like wallpaper. It's just kind of there, and I'm not really sure that it will have any impact on the outcome of elections, but I certainly do hope that the justice system does hold these individuals accountable for the alleged crimes that they have committed. I don't have as much hope for the justice system holding Donald Trump accountable. I'm just very concerned about whether we'll ever see any of these other trials happen. But that's a different story.
Malia.
Yeah, let's remember that these people who have been indicted now, they were all parties to one of eight lawsuits in Arizona that were all dismissed before this particular group went forward with their slate of fake electors. So I agree with Ira that it seems like there's an enormous amount of very clear evidence in this case. Whether Donald Trump himself will be held accountable either through the justice systems or the court of public opinion is a different story. But it seems like there's a lot of very strong, just on the surface, strong evidence against this particular group. Because they did, they did try to go through the courts first. And when that didn't work, they tried their own extrajudicial methods. And so now they're going to see how their extrajudicial methods hold up in an actual judicial setting.
Are any of the three of you comfortable with the, not comfortable, that's the wrong word, knowledgeable enough in the crime, in the process of the crime they committed to refresh listeners on the details of what they are being indicted for? I know we've talked about it, but I think in language that assumes people who are listening know what we're talking about. Maybe Terry?
I hesitate to take on that role because I'm not a lawyer.
Sure.
And I wouldn't want to mislead listeners into, that my opinion somehow is accurate. It's clear that there is this effort to elect a slate of fake electors. I know that is part of it. Beyond that, I would really prefer that somebody with more legal expertise than me.
Well, I don't know if that's me, but I think that's what you just said is the heart of it. They're supposed to be electors from each state, but based on the number of votes each state are allowed to have for the Electoral College, and this group of people, led by, we believe, the unindicted co-conspirator, didn't like the way it was going to unfold. So they, in effect, appointed themselves as alternate electors. And it's one of those things where you say all the time, if this was a movie, you wouldn't believe the plot.
Right. I do keep asking the air, the cosmos, why did they think they could designate fake electors?
Yeah, and how do they think they could get away with it?
Right.
So. No, Sarah, I will say that if I believe I'm correct, and please check me if I'm not, that that Congress, and also signed by the president, did pass a Election Reform Act recently that makes what they tried to do illegal. It was actually addressed. So I'm not sure how possible it might be for someone to do this in the future. I think some of the avenues that were available for them to do this have been closed by legislation that didn't exist in the past. So that's also good news. I do still want to just take this opportunity to promote the real need to abolish our Electoral College.
Malia?
Well, I just also want to point out that what these folks did, in addition to the acts that they've been indicted for, I mean, they really called into question how our voting system works. And so in addition to filing the lawsuit and setting up this slate of fake electors, they forced all kinds of investigations and threw doubt on how, for example, Maricopa County, which I believe is the most populous county in Arizona, whether they the officials that oversee voting there actually implemented the vote in a way that was fair and open. And there was no reason to believe that they didn't until this group came through and decided to throw doubt on everything. Just they're willing to burn everything down just in order to support Donald Trump as president, and that includes the voting system of the United States. So I agree with Terry that the Electoral College has long been due for a relook, all kinds of reform. It's complicated. It's confusing. But it's what we have now. And there was no evidence of widespread fraud. And yet these people and who they represent continue to, and I believe they'll do so going into this election as well. I mean, as we've seen that they'll continue to try to draw doubts about how the voting actually proceeds in this country.
And they've largely succeeded. I mean, the mission completed, as George W. Bush might have said, they have successfully thrown enough shade on the elections and the election system and the legal system that a large number of people in this country don't trust it anymore. And they've ripped it down, and they've punched holes into it, and they haven't. They've just let public opinion run amok among those diehards who don't believe. I mean, if you go online or watch some of the programs and you see interviews with supporters of the MAGA movement, it's incredible what their opinions are. They're often stymied. You know, you got one guy blaming Obama for 9/11, for 9/11. Where was Obama on 9/11? I mean, those kinds of things have become a fabric of the media that they're listening to, and they believe it. And whatever happens, however Arizona is adjudicated, as with all the other Trump trials, a large number of people are simply not going to believe it. They're going to believe it was all rigged. And I don't know how long it's going to take for the historical view of the legal system to be repaired.
And the sad irony of all that is that our voting system doesn't work without armies of volunteers who show up and run the polling places. I mean, I used to do that when I lived in the D.C. area, and I felt like it was part of my civic duty. And I see people doing that here in New York as well. And everywhere I've lived, like, that's how our voting system works. I mean, there are professionals who oversee it, but then each polling site, it wouldn't work without volunteers. So it is our fellow citizens who are running these places for us. And if people who are concerned about fraud want to make sure there's no fraud, they're welcome to volunteer as well. Do your civic duty.
Terry?
Yeah, I was just going to say on the Electoral College, the format of it, how it's set up, how it operates, it does easily lend itself to conspiracy theories, because it's sort of this mysterious thing that happens after the election where these people that you don't know go in and make these decisions. The average voter doesn't understand who these people are, where they come from, how they get there, what they do. It just is an open system that you can see how people can easily mount conspiracy theories against it. It's just one of the many reasons why we need to abolish it and have a more transparent voting system. And it is continues to be so odd to me that, as was just said, we have a system that does rely on volunteers to come out and support the election. And your vote very much does count for every single office you vote for, whether it's city council or mayor or state legislature or Congress. But when we get to the president, the highest office in the land, we have a completely different system in how we count the votes. And that inconsistency, I think, is just really damaging, as this last round showed, with Trump trying to take advantage of that sort of mystery aspect of it. And just another reason why I think that we really need to make strong efforts to abolish it and reform it. And I hope that we will begin to elect more people at the state level and the federal level that will get behind that idea.
Biden won Arizona by more than 10,000 votes in 2020. Of the 8 lawsuits that unsuccessfully challenged Biden's victory in the state, that might have been a Freudian slip, unsuccessfully challenged Biden's victory in the state, one was filed by the 11 Republicans. Their lawsuit asked a judge to decertify the results that gave Biden his victory in Arizona and block the state from sending them to the Electoral College. In dismissing the case, U.S. District Judge Diane Humatewa said the Republicans lacked legal standing, waited too long to bring their case, and failed to provide the court with factual support for their extraordinary claims. Days after that lawsuit was dismissed, the 11 participated in the certificate signing. The Arizona charges come after a strike of indictments against fake electors in other states. In December, a Nevada grand jury indicted six Republicans on felony charges of offering a false instrument for filing and uttering a forged instrument and connected with false election certificates. They have pleaded not guilty. There's a lot to follow. We will keep abreast of the situation, of course. It is time now, though, for our first break of the morning. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. The panelists today, Malia Dumont, Ira Fussfeld, and Terry Gibson. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and we will return shortly. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. Here with you for just over 15 minutes more this morning with our panelists, Malia Dumont, Ira Fussfeld, and Terry Gibson. At about 9:50, shortly after 9:50, we will switch over to NPR's live special coverage of the Supreme Court hearing oral arguments in the case of Trump versus the United States. It's a presidential immunity case in the Supreme Court, and the justices will hear oral arguments this morning. We will flip over to that in a little while. Let us begin now discussing the protests on college campuses. This from the New York Times. A wave of pro-Palestinian protests spread and intensified on Wednesday as students gathered on campuses around the country, in some cases facing off with the police in a widening shutdown over campus speech and the war in Israel, in Gaza. University administrators from Texas to California moved to clear protesters and prevent encampments from taking hold on their own campuses, as they have at Columbia University, deploying police in tense new confrontations that have already led to dozens of arrests. At the same time, new protests continued erupting in places like Pittsburgh and San Antonio. Students expressed solidarity with their fellow students at Columbia and with a movement that appeared to be galvanized by the pushback on other campuses and the looming end of the academic year. Protesters on several campuses said their demands included divestment by their universities from companies connected to the Israeli military campaign in Gaza, disclosure of those and other investments, and a recognition of the continuing right to protest without punishment. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. And for this one, I will begin with Malia, please.
Oh, gee, thanks. I want to share an email I got this morning from the Harvard Club of New York City, where I am a member. I think most of the listening audience knows I got my undergraduate degree at Bard, but I went to Harvard for my master's degree, and I've been a member of the Harvard Club for quite some time. It's my office away from the office when I'm in New York City. And I should, for full disclosure, say I used to work at Harvard, too, and I'm glad I don't anymore.
Sorry, Terry.
So this email, I'm sorry, say again.
I said, sorry, Terry, who currently works at Harvard.
Oh, sorry. Well, it was a little, I mean, I think there's a difference between being on the faculty and being sort of administrative, which I was. So I got this email this morning, and, you know, I'm grateful for the education I received at Harvard. I'm glad I was part of that community, but I've just over the past couple of years, really starting during COVID, when I thought the university did a terrible job managing that situation, and they just showed, and even more so now, how risk averse they are. And this email I got this morning from the Harvard Club sort of shows that. It's an invitation to attend a Zoom event on the future of Palestine, and this is how they describe the event, and introduce it. We are treading cautiously into programming involving the Israel-Hamas war because it is contentious, and no matter what one says or feels, controversy follows. So we will address a question for which there is no implied judgment: what is Palestine going to look like a year from now or five? And they're bringing in a CIA veteran who has a lot of experience in the region to talk about that. So I looked at this email and I thought, first of all, like, it's taken this, you know, Harvard Club of New York City over 6 months to determine how they want to address this issue, which is, you know, one of the most important things in the world right now. It's galvanizing students on college campuses. It's affecting foreign policy in the Middle East, and arguably the most famous university in the world, in the greatest city in the world, decides that their priorities are avoiding contentiousness and controversy, and only asking questions for which there's no implied judgment. So I think this sort of points to the level of risk aversion that has led to a huge vacuum in intellectual leadership at a lot of universities around the country on these issues. They're not modeling the kind of behavior that helps people, including their own students, understand that you can talk about contentious issues and not have it devolve into horrible protests and arrests. It's obviously much harder on a huge urban campus, like where a lot of these protests are taking place. But there are places, there are many, many colleges and universities in this country where people are having important conversations and they are taking intellectual leadership. And unfortunately, you don't hear about those as much. So I worry about the all kinds of implications, including for people's trust in the value of higher education. I think the way university leaders have handled this, including the hearings in front of Congress, has caused a lot of people to doubt the intellectual leadership in this country.
The demonstrations have spread overseas as well, with students on campuses in Cairo, Paris, and Sydney, Australia, gathering to voice support for Palestinians in opposition to the war. As new protests were emerging, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, visited the Columbia campus in New York, where university officials were seeking to negotiate with protest leaders. The Speaker of the House has also called on President Biden to do something. Terry.
Well, I think that what was just said is very clear. And I agree with much of what was just said. I feel like we are at a time where higher education was already being challenged in a variety of ways in its ability to really adapt to the 21st century and modern technology and trying to provide pathways for a more equitable student body that actually looks like this country. And this now, with the Israel-Palestine-Gaza conflict, is really testing all of the leadership. Certainly here where I work at Harvard, we know that has occurred and continues to occur. There is a new encampment on Harvard Yard now by students, and it's going to be interesting to see how the current president deals with that. I have been a proponent of really trying to encourage my employer, Harvard, as well as other universities as well, to really reach out and try to bring in people that are not part of the higher education system, people that have experience in public relations, people that have experience in politics and political campaigns. So I think there is a real disconnect in how they are communicating with the public. Like they have been taking way too much advice from lawyers and not nearly enough advice from people that understand how to speak with empathy, how to communicate as a human being, and how to really find ways to constructively enter into conversation with those who have opposing views and find some way to bring them together to try to find compromise. Instead, their language has all too often been part of what's created the division, because they can't quite figure out exactly how to address it, because I don't think they really have the training and the skills to do so. And we just kind of keep going around and around this vicious circle. And I am concerned about where we're headed with this. And I'm really concerned about how this is going to impact our upcoming presidential election. And I really would like to see Joe Biden be more vocal on this, be more transparent on it. I think it is between that and immigration, the two issues that could really potentially damage him. And of course, let's not forget the people in both Gaza and Israel that are being severely impacted by all of this. So this is a delicate time, to say the least.
Well, my frame of reference for this is being a student at New Paltz College in the late 60s, right up to 1970 when I graduated. And when I graduated, shortly before I was graduated, the students at New Paltz protesting what had happened at Kent State only days before protested and took over the main building. The history of protest on college campuses is part of the fabric of our society, I believe. The whole concept of academic freedom, of students learning from their mistakes, hopefully. And I think the current protest is, as it's spread around the country, is a manifestation of the historical trend. What concerns me about the current protests is, and unless my memory is horrible, and it might be, I never felt threatened, or students who might not have agreed with what the protesters were protesting never felt physically threatened. And the nature of this dispute and the war in Gaza, it seems to me it's changed the rhetoric, and it's led to some of the hesitation that Malia and Terry just described on Harvard's campus. I'm surprised, frankly, that there haven't been more protests on more college campuses, New Paltz being one of them, Bard being another. Malia, I don't believe there's been anything going on at Bard. Tell me if I'm wrong. But again, I don't believe there's anything inherently wrong with these protests, except if they cross a line and threaten people. Threaten people's safety.
I think it's reasonable to expect. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
We'll do Malia first.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Sorry about that. This is what happens when we got all these remote folks.
Of course. Yep.
So, first, just the mention of Kent State. I mean, I went to high school in Ohio. My mom retired from Kent State. And I just remember the first time we ever went there when she started working there, the first thing we did, because she was a child of the 60s and protested Vietnam, is visit the memorial that's on that campus. That's sort of loomed large in my consciousness since I was fairly young. But to just respond to, two things. First, Ira's questions about, what's been happening at Bard. We do have a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at Bard, like many, many colleges and universities do around the country. And we had a big event on campus recently. We had a big open house for all of our admitted students who are trying to decide if they're going to come to Bard. And the Students for Justice in Palestine, of course, they wanted to, to take advantage of the fact they're going to be a huge audience on campus. So what did they do? They printed out some really nice pamphlets of about Palestine, and they stood around in various places on campus and asked all of our visitors, would you like to learn about Bard's connections to Palestine? And it turns out that Bard College is the only institution of higher education in America that has a dual degree program with a Palestinian university. We've been doing this for over 15 years. And so we have long-standing connections, like really substantial connections to people and institutions in Israel and Palestine. And so our students are aware of that. They're exposed to that. And we haven't, unlike the Harvard Club of New York City, haven't shied away from talking about these things. And right after October 7th, we started holding all kinds of events with lots of different faculty and student groups. And so the modeling of the behavior, first of all, of that it's possible to talk about these things and not physically attack each other, has been really important on the life of our campus. But also the fact that Bard has been out in front on this particular issue, because it's true anywhere around the world. If there is severe inequity in access to higher education, and for educational institutions, so that's what, that's what we care about. When there's severe inequity in access, that has all kinds of terrible implications for people's lives, for democracy. And so we at Bard are interested in that. And that's how we got involved in Palestine in the first place over 15 years ago. Now, just very briefly to get to what Terry was saying before about, these university presidents, you know, talking to lawyers and not being really empathetic. I mean, why are they defaulting? These are not stupid people at all. Why are they defaulting to such a risk-averse mentality? And I think a lot of it comes back to the increasingly untenable financial structure of higher education in this country. And we as citizens are partly responsible for that because we have allowed our public, our elected officials to invest less and less in education. And that's partly one of the causes of this current crisis.
Terry?
Yeah, that's a great point. No, that's a great point. That had we been properly investing in public education, certainly at the higher education level across this country, the dynamic, I think, would be very different. You have a system, obviously, at Harvard and other Ivy League schools where they rely heavily on alumni and other donors that have a lot of leverage over how the university conducts itself. And that is going to inevitably lead to situations where the president and the administration is put into difficult decision-making processes that could alienate those financial gains, which they desperately need to keep offering what they offer. I will say Harvard is doing some things to try to address this. They are in the program, in the division that I work in, we are going to be piloting a new civil discourse class next semester, where students can sign up and really participate actively in class in learning how to discuss very controversial issues in a civil way. And if that pilot is successful, then the idea is to roll it out and make it a much wider offering for the entire campus. And I am involved in that to some degree, and I'm excited to see where that heads. But I think we're going to need more than that across this country to really bring civil discourse back to not only college campuses, but just to our local town halls and to our local council meetings and just to in our neighborhood backyards. We all kind of need to go back to communication 101 and remember how important it is to engage our fellow citizens in conversations, even if they are about things that we don't necessarily agree with, but that we can, and we do have a history of being able to do it in ways that allow us to find compromise, move forward, and to not completely damage, bring our entire country to a halt, which is what seems to be happening now.
We will have to take the panel to a full halt for today, as it is time now to switch over to special coverage. Thank you very much to Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, Preceptor in Public Speaking for Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue. Thank you all very much, and special coverage is next.